the nexus and where you'll really excel in a meeting with me and with Misma is when you can optimize for those two things, where the world is dying for the thing you can build, and only you can build it because of your technological prowess or your access or your insight.
I am sitting in the heart of Tel Aviv at Misma VC, the Misra Ma'arav VC Fund with partner Aaron Applebaum. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming by.
So there's several questions that we had listeners ask about and really would love to clarify. Can you share with me a little bit of what a life of VC looks like for just a few minutes? I was had the pleasure of going to the restroom and I saw a shower in your restroom. So is that something about I'm implying that there's also bedrooms on the floor as well?
It would be an accurate assumption. I'm here often very, very late. So VC is a fascinating industry. It's a place where I get to professionally learn and professionally sit with people who are far smarter than I am, and learn about what the world's going to look like in 25 years. And if we have chemistry and our visions align, I, in my own way, get to help. And in this case, it's with capital. And so a VC wakes up early, meets young or old, talented, insightful, smart entrepreneurs who are trying to change their world using their technological backgrounds and their drive. And we get to be a piece of that larger puzzle. And it's fun, it's exhilarating, and that's what keeps us here early in the morning until late at night.
So you mentioned that you moved from America 2 years ago and are managing Misma's operations. You just became partner recently. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something in the first couple of years of the fund, when you just started, you had a big learning curve. Can you share with me a little bit about the learning curve?
Absolutely. So Israel was a completely new ecosystem for me. I was lucky to have the language. My Hebrew is not bad, having lived here my sophomore year of high school. But in terms of understanding who was good at what VC should I be in contact with, what accelerators should I look at their companies, who should I look to collaborate with, who are the corporate VCs and the corporate partners who are interested in working with us. And in order to do so, it was a very brute force mentality where I would post up, I would go to a cafe somewhere in Tel Aviv and take meetings from 8:30 in the morning till way past sundown, meeting engineers, CEOs, VCs, accelerators, incubators, lawyers, accountants of every shape and size to really understand a topography and where I could situate myself within this ecosystem to, one, get very, very good deal flow, and to help build a portfolio that could ultimately return a lot of shareholder value. And so I kissed a lot of frogs in the process.
Amazing. So tell me just a little bit about how does the business of a VC work? Just for the individuals who try to get inside the mentality of what is a VC looking for? How does the business and economics of a VC work?
Sure. So VC is broadly considered an alternative asset class. So the idea is there is a limited partner and a general partner. The limited partner is a pool of capital whose goal is to have that capital grow. So they give the general partner a dollar and in a few years expect that dollar to turn into 3 or 5 or 10. Now, the process with which that works is the general partnership, the investors, go around looking for high growth opportunities in fields that are predefined. In our case, it's connected autonomous vehicles, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, enterprise software, things for which Israel has some competitive advantage. And we look for the companies at an early stage that our capital can help grow the business into a larger company. And then when some sort of liquidity event happens, whether that's an M&A event or an initial public offering or some sort of secondary sale, then ideally, the value of our portion of the company grew as the overall value of the company grows. We then pay the LP the benefits, the proceeds of that maturation.
Amazing. So what is the typical return that your fund looks for when they're looking for investments? Are you a seed round?
Right. So we're pre-growth. So seed A and B.
Mm-hmm.
So, and by the way, also venture formation. In the past, we've also, which is something we can cover, is we've actually helped found companies alongside the entrepreneurs themselves. And so what we look to do is at each one of those stages, look to add a certain type of value. So in the pre-seed or seed round, it's not only the capital, it's also bringing in the initial customers, help them form the roadmap for building out an IP portfolio, helping them attract additional financing even before they have a product, doing the market research to make sure we're hitting the product market fit. In the A's, it's a set of entrepreneurs who have figured out the product market fit and now need to build that sales and marketing team to really help them proliferate that technology globally, which is also where we tend to be very helpful with our deep connections, both in East Asia and in the United States, which is something we can touch on. And then at the B, it's a matter of pure scale. And each one of those types of investments have different return profiles. The later the stage, the less risk you're taking, the less reward you'll ultimately receive, at least theoretically. And we have our portfolio is very stage stratified, risk stratified to make sure that we're not concentrating too heavily in any one area. We'll look to have the 20-25% IRR of a good fund, and we're tracking higher than that even, but we'll see. Still early days.
So as a curiosity for me, you're seeing in the first year you mentioned you had hundreds of meetings,
right?
And you made one investment.
So that was in 2017. I joined in June, so it was the first, call it half a year, where we made one investment. 2018 was markedly different, where we were the second most active fund in Israel. So over the duration from January of 18 to December, we invested in 9 companies.
So you were essentially, it seems like you were extremely patient in the beginning. Once you understood the topography of the landscape, you felt confident to be able to make the right decisions for your limited partners. How do you look at an investment? So you made several investments in 2018, you said, and then you know you have the risk of this. Some of them are very highly risky investments. You have on one hand full faith and the confidence in this investment and an entrepreneur. On the other hand, you know statistically the chances of them succeeding are low. So how do you balance that world of certainty and at the same time managing risk?
So a few ways of answering that question. So the first off, Israeli investors tend not to do what the equivalents in Silicon Valley do, which is whale hunting. So in Silicon Valley, it's also known as the Babe Ruth effect. You swing really hard at a bunch of fastballs, and then when you finally connect, it's a grand slam, you return your fund. In Israel, you see some of that, some very successful whales, some grand slams, but a lot of singles, doubles, and triples also. So you see a lot of exits in the 100 million, half a billion range. And instead of having a 10% success rate, you may have a 30% or a 40% success rate within a portfolio. And so it brings down the risk, brings down the reward a little bit, but gives you returns that are equivalent to our peers in Silicon Valley through a slightly different method.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one.
Interesting.
So our statistics aren't quite as dire. That being said, we're still in the business where the majority of companies won't succeed. When we invest...
Yeah, this is not the goldfish business.
This is exactly right. We're not panning for gold, exactly. Okay. And by the way, as active investors who take board seats and lead rounds and really handhold a lot of our entrepreneurs, you know, the navigation to make sure that we're not just saying, you're not tracking, you're out. We make sure that we continue to sort of lend help and give these companies as best a chance as possible at every step in the way until it absolutely can't work.
Got it.
We invest in entrepreneurs that have good chemistry amongst themselves and with us, who have a good handle on technology, have a good handle on the space, where even if their business fails, we would go ahead and fund their next venture.
Interesting.
So when we make investments, we do so much heavy diligence, commercial diligence, and human diligence, and that by the time we're comfortable investing in a company, even if that company isn't destined for success, the pieces are there such that we would take a similar bet in a tangential or different field with those same people.
Can you talk about human diligence?
Sure.
I think that's actually the first time I heard that.
Absolutely.
That concept. Can you share a little bit, how do you go through a human diligence process?
So it's particularly interesting in Israel for a few reasons. So human diligence is, how is this person as a manager? How is this person as a leader? How is this person as a familyman? How is this person under tense moments or stressful moments? What is this person motivated by? Is it money? Is it success? Is it fame? Is it recognition? All of these things that make a human tick, and humans are very complicated. You'll never nail it. But you can at least get the shape and size of a human to understand what you're dealing with. Are they going to take an offer as soon as it comes in? Because for them, a certain amount of money is meaningful and they'll leave all of their investors out to dry, or are they in it for the long haul? Do they have that stick-with-itness and resilience? And part of the reason that human diligence in Israel is, one, so powerful, and two, so easy, is everyone goes through the same military process, where they all have commanders, they all have cadets, they all have, within the first 5 minutes of meeting an Israeli, knowing what they did in the military and with whom, their commander is a couple calls away. The technology ecosystem is small enough that their previous employer is two phone calls away maximum. And so you can call with their permission, right? None of this is underhanded, but with their permission and above board, you can get from the people who are instrumental in building this human as a human and as an entrepreneur, you can get a very, very good sense for what they're going to be like when revenues aren't hitting and the board's yelling at them and customers are churning and they still need to build a big business and you've got your limited partnership that's expecting returns. And you know, so when all of these things are at heightened moments, the human diligence really kicks in to understand how these folks will react.
Incredible. A question, when we talk about Olim entrepreneurs who haven't gone through that process like the army,
sure.
Are they at a disadvantage here? If they're starting a business because they don't have that infrastructure they went through, they're coming from a very different set of experiences, relationships, they're coming in here and they're looking to build a company or looking for investment. How did they go through that human diligence process? How did they prepare themselves?
So there are advantages and disadvantages. So a clear disadvantage is you can't just say 8249, okay, this guy's good at cyber, right? They don't have that little tagline that alleviates a lot of the doubt very quickly. What they do have is communication skills, sales skills, and understanding of markets in a way that most Israelis can never really get to. The ability to communicate a product, the ability to interact with what is still the primary market for Israeli technology companies, which is the United States. Europe and Asia are in their own rights growing and important. There's a finesse that an American entrepreneur often has that can be advantageous. We have our own CVs, which not every Israeli knows how to read, but our university system in a lot of ways acts as our military service, our university system, with whatever we majored in, with whatever our jobs were. If you're a Columbia graduate who spent time at Google, then your chance at successfully building a company aren't any less than an 8249 guy who did Keva and spent 7 years and is now out working with his unit. It's a different communication process and you have to play to different strengths, but there are certainly ways of building that narrative in successful ways. And we look for that balance, by the way. We look for deep technologists, we look for people who are the best and brightest in Israel, and we look to make sure that they're rounding themselves out with people who are good communicators and may have that US or European or East Asian finesse.
Incredible. So can you share, in the few moments that we have together, can you share a little bit of if an individual wants to meet with you, right, and they're getting ready for a meeting with a VC or mm-hmm. someone that they're looking for to be a partner, how do they prepare for a meeting like that? Like what kind of audit, self-audit, do they need to have in order to before they meet you?
It's a great question. So a mentor of mine, a gentleman named Ohad Finkelstein, said that he looks for, now he's been in this business a long time, probably has more meetings than I do, and so in his condensed schedule, he says he looks for two things. He tells the entrepreneurs to flip to two pages. Team and the glimmer of greatness. The glimmer of greatness is, what's the billion-dollar idea? How are you changing the world? If you don't get there, you'll certainly fall in a place that still has value and is still helpful. What's driving this? What's the game-changing vision? And then why are you the right people to take us there? And if you can answer those two questions, then he'll sit in the meeting with you. I would say I have a little bit more time than him. And I would say that those are two pillars that you should think about. If I were to add a third, I would say not just what and who, but I would say why. Why now? Why is the world looking for what you're building? Why is there a need? And that's, by the way, we talked about human diligence. That's the commercial diligence. If I were to pick up the phone and call your potential customers, are they excited or not? Does it require you to educate them or not? And the question is why? So if you are building something that's the most amazing piece of technology that no one's asking for, you'll fail. If you're building something that everybody needs, even if it's not that technologically savvy, I would prefer that. The nexus and where you'll really excel in a meeting with me and with Misma is when you can optimize for those two things, where the world is dying for the thing you can build, and only you can build it because of your technological prowess or your access or your
insight. That's a beautiful insight. Can you say that one more time? Because that is such a beautiful line, right? It's that meeting point between what the world needs and why you're uniquely placed to build it. That's
exactly right.
That is just sweet. Exactly. Sweet! Sweet. In last two questions before I know you have to go shortly. What is the thing that excites you over the next 20 years? Like, what is the technology? If I'm an entrepreneur or if I'm a person who just made Aliyah and I want to be somewhere where the future is, right? You're constantly looking at now what's happening now. You're looking at what the next 10, 12, 15, 20 years are. Like, where should we be looking? Like, where do we need to look as Olim, as a potential where Israel could be as far as a force that we could help build?
Yeah, it's important to look at supply-demand imbalances. So where do you have global demand for something that Israelis are uniquely equipped to supply? So if you think about, for example, the future of the connected autonomous vehicle, Israel's never successfully built an automobile. They tried, there was a program in whatever it was, the 60s or 70s, cars made out of small little ugly cars made out of fiberglass that the camels would eat the paint. There's no reason that Israel would excel in the connected autonomous electrified vehicle. But when it comes to securing devices, when it comes to machine-to-machine communication, when it comes to orchestration and command and control, when it comes to sensors and sensor fusion and the intelligent usage of big data, those are all tools that are essential for the next 50 years of the connected autonomous car, of mobility generally. And so while Israel isn't a car building country, it has the tools missing from the Germanys of the world or the Detroits of the world or the Japans of the world that have the know-how and can build doors and have press shops but are missing that special piece. If you think about the future of artificial intelligence, Amazon isn't here. I mean, Amazon has R&D here. But the lion's share of Amazon and of Microsoft, that's up in Seattle, and Google's out in the Bay Area. So what does Israel have to offer? But if you think about the future of AI, it's about intelligent storage and queryability and usage of big data. And where was the Pentium chip produced, designed and produced? It was here at Intel in the Israeli R&D Center. The Mellanox acquisition by NVIDIA, the Mobileye acquisition by Intel. These are all clear signs that there are something, whether it's in silicon, whether it's in fabrication, whether it's in the software layer that goes on top. The future of AI, as we're going to have to store things and process more, and machines are going to start creating so much more data than ever before, GPUs, co-processing units, are an amazing place for people to be spending their time. If you think about, there's an entrepreneur we're actually about to invest in, and his military service was to break the firewall as the firewall was being built. So the guy next to him was building the very first firewall, what ultimately became, you know, the precursor to the checkpoint firewall. Mm. He was already tasked with breaking that. And so areas of cybersecurity, cloud, serverless, traditional, hardcore, deep technological, B2B enterprise software solutions, Israel will excel. And that's where you have tremendous demand from the global partners, from the global corporates. So I would look at those areas. Now, by the way, it doesn't mean that you necessarily have to be deeply technical. The ability to communicate the supply-demand delta and the ability to get the right meetings with the right people at the right places at the right time is power enough. And by the way, that's where Misma prides itself, prides ourself, is on being able to get the right people in front of the ultimate buyers of technologies globally. As an Olé, as someone who's breaking into this new ecosystem, don't compete where a better version could possibly exist in Silicon Valley or in China, because they have more money in China and they have more engineers in Silicon Valley. There has to be a reason that the Israeli version of something has at least the potential to be the best in the world. And that's where you should be spending your time.
Incredible, incredible. Final words from you that the individuals who are listening would benefit from. What would you like to share with them?
Endeavor to make Israeli friends. It's not a small task, and I'm not being prescriptive here on how to do that per se. But it's important, I think, and some of my closest friends as a result of this have come from my breaking my teeth and going out with folks who, you know, I'm not naturally a quiet person. In some circles, I'm known as a very quiet person because I'm taking in more than I'm giving out, more than I'm sharing. And some of that's a language thing. Some of that's a cultural thing. It's worth the pain and it's worth being labeled quiet in order to be around the folks who are the hub to unseen, unimaginable spokes to other elements of their friend groups and of Israeli culture. So spend time with Israelis and remember that you've got a lot of, talking about supply-demand imbalances, there are a lot of skills that being Olé provides that I don't know that people are necessarily taking advantage of, especially in the communication and the marketing and the sales and the existing relationships. Most Olim have pre-existing relationships with their counterparts in the United States, whether that's from their former jobs or their synagogues, or those are valuable connections that Israelis don't have. Make sure to take advantage of those.
Amazing. I'm so grateful for what you shared with me. I personally am taking it very much to heart, and I'm really grateful for you hosting me in your office. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time as well.